WBFO, AM 970, and Leadership Buffalo welcome you to Buffalo City Forum, our occasional speaker series. Today's guest is Bruce Katz, Vice President of the Brookings Institution and an advisor to the Western New York Regional Economic Council. He's here to talk about Buffalo's next economy. Major support for Buffalo City Forum has been provided by Independent Health. Additional support provided by M&T Bank. Now let's go to the podium and moderator Jim Ranney.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for another Buffalo City Forum. In addition to our audience on 88.7 FM, WBFO, and AM 970, we have a full studio audience with us today, anxious to hear from our guest, Bruce Katz. Mr. Katz is Vice President of the Brookings Institution and the Founding Director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program, which works with decision-makers, along with the public and private sector, to improve the prosperity of cities. Bruce has lectured on this topic across the United States, as well as in Canada, China, Germany, Great Britain, and South Africa. He is a graduate of Brown University and Yale Law School. Now, we all know about Governor Cuomo's pledge of $1 billion for Buffalo, the goal to encourage companies to expand or locate here to create jobs and to stop the outward flow of population. In making the announcement back in January, the governor said, "We must address the crisis in Western New York." He said it's gone on for too long. And he said, quote, "We can rebuild Buffalo." Those are welcome words, but there are plenty of questions left unanswered. Where will the money come from? What should we do with it? What businesses should we seek? And does Buffalo mean just Buffalo? Or can the $1 billion be used outside of the city? The governor has turned to a longtime friend to help answer those questions. Bruce Katz is working with the Western New York Regional Economic Development Council to come up with ideas and a game plan for that $1 billion. Should we build on biomedical technology and the progress we've seen in the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus? Should we pursue so-called renewable energy? Do we look to companies like Yahoo or Google and try to lure them to Buffalo? Do we invest in our roots, like the auto industry or cultural tourism? What would the experts say? Well, fortunately, one of them is with us this afternoon. Delivering the Next Economy in Buffalo is the title of his presentation. Please welcome to Buffalo City Forum, Bruce Katz.
So, thank you, Jim. And it's an absolute pleasure and privilege to be back in Buffalo, which I believe is one of America's and the world's most distinctive cities and metropolitan areas. And I want to put the so-called Buffalo Billion in context today and lay out a vision for how the United States and this metropolitan area moves forward in the aftermath of the Great Recession, led by cities and metros that drive our economy and, frankly, all the economies around the world. I'll start with this admonition from George Bernard Shaw that the sign of an educated person is to be deeply moved by statistics. So don't take any notes. My text will be online tomorrow. But I think at the most basic level, not just this city and metropolis and region, but the entire country needs more jobs, 11.4 million by one estimate, just to recover the jobs that we lost during the downturn and keep pace with population growth and labor market dynamics. We also need better jobs to reverse decades-long growth in inequality and to help increase wages and incomes for American workers. There's no easy fix to that. Our economy, this economy, must be purposefully restructured from one that has been focused inward and characterized by consumption and debt to one that is globally engaged and driven by production and innovation. So here's my proposition. First, we must move to a next economy, one that is driven by exports, powered by low carbon, fueled by innovation, and rich with opportunity. That is a vision where we export more, we waste less, we actually innovate in what matters, we produce and deploy more of what we invent, and we actually ensure that the economy works for working families. Second, that economy will largely be metropolitan in form and function. Our major metros, the top 100, and Buffalo is the 50th largest, generate more than three-quarters of our GDP. We have nostalgia over small-town America, but it's metropolitan America, the cities, the suburbs, and the small towns that drive our national economy and will determine our prosperity. You are a charter member of that elite club of metropolitan engines. You are a special economy with an enviable trading location, rich natural and architectural history, distinctive competitive assets, attributes, and advantages. Where others see deficits, I see possibilities, particularly as the broader U.S. economy restructures and retools. And finally, it's time to build the next economy by unleashing the entrepreneurial engines and dynamism of these metropolitan areas. Now, if this was an ideal world, we would have a national government that would set a platform. They would invest in advanced R&D. They would transform infrastructure. They would overhaul immigration. They would set a set of standards for business to excel. But the United States circa 2012 is not an ideal world. Ideologues do rule our airwaves. Washington is fundamentally broken. So we're going to have to do this the hard way, through what we call a pragmatic caucus. City and metropolitan leaders and state leaders across many sectors and disciplines who put place over party and collaboration over conflict and evidence over dogma. That is happening already in city after city, metro after metro, and state after state, where pragmatic leaders are collaborating to compete and are following a new economic playbook to spur productive, sustainable, and inclusive growth. And I think Buffalo and New York State can lead that innovative wave. Governor Cuomo is charting a new course for economic growth in this state. And regions like Buffalo and Western New York are responding with imaginative strategies. So the governor's billion-dollar challenge is exactly the kind of inspirational, gutsy, and transformative intervention you need at this point to leverage private sector innovation and capital and spur smart and strategic growth. Let me begin by offering briefly a vision for the next economy. Let's begin with exports and the need to fully engage the world. Let's visualize an economy where more firms in more sectors trade more goods and services seamlessly with the world, particularly with those countries that are rapidly urbanizing and industrializing. So why exports? Because we've crossed an economic Rubicon. Together, Brazil, India, and China, the BRICS, are expected to account for about a fifth of global GDP this year, surpassing the United States for the first time. By 2015, their share will grow to more than 25%. Their rise is the rise of their cities and metros. For the first time in recorded history, more than half of the world's population lives in cities and metropolitan areas. By 2030, that share will rise to 60%. The locus of economic power in this world is shifting. The top 30 metro performers in the world today are exclusively in Asia and Latin America. The 30 worst performers today are in the United States, in Europe, and earthquake-ravaged Japan. We need to reorient our economy to take advantage of that new demand. But in 2010, exports made up only 13% of U.S. GDP. Compared to 30% in China, 30% in Canada, 30% in Mexico, and much higher levels in India and the European Union. Now, in this country, the movement of freight is already compromised by congestion, by transport networks that are clogged and congested, and an infrastructure that at times feels more like a third-world country than a first-world country. And culturally, let's admit it, we don't get out much. Only 28% of Americans even have a passport. Can we get back into the export game? I think the answer is decidedly yes. We still manufacture, you still manufacture, a range of advanced goods that the rest of the world wants. Aircraft, spacecraft, electrical machinery, precision surgical instruments, high-quality pharmaceuticals. And we have a trade surplus in services, $153 billion in 2010, and are poised for a quantum leap in the export of high-value services. Low carbon is the second hallmark of the next U.S. economy, And let's imagine a world where we are the vanguard, the United States, of the clean energy revolution, which is the next industrial revolution. Everything is already beginning to change. The energy we use is migrating from an almost exclusive focus on carbon-based fuels to a more sustainable mix. The infrastructure we build is shifting from outmoded transport and energy to systems that are smarter, faster, technologically enabled. The products we buy are moving from high-carbon gas guzzlers to an eclectic basket of green, sustainable goods. And the homes we live in and the office and retail buildings we frequent are more sustainable in design, more efficient in their use of water and energy, and better arrayed so that people can spend less, walk more, live a higher quality of life. Our competitors, China, Germany, Brazil, have embraced the green economy. They're creating markets, they're growing jobs, they're stimulating investment. Can we play in the low-carbon revolution? Our research at Brookings shows that we already have a strong base, and I'll talk about the Buffalo statistics, of 2.7 million clean economy jobs in a broad range of sectors. And the clean economy super sector is more export-oriented, more innovation-oriented, and more manufacturing-oriented than the economy as a whole. It's exactly the kind of economy we want to build post-recession. That leads to a discussion of innovation. We must continue to be the world's innovation nation, not just a hothouse of invention, but a platform for advanced production. I think, and I know everyone in this room must feel it, we're on the cusp of some kind of technological acceleration. We see it with vehicles. We see it with our own homes. We see it in the health sector with all the potential of technology. The hottest wave in technology today, frankly, is not about the individual. It's about the collective. It's about the smart city. Global companies across the world are on a mission to connect cities within and without through the integrated application of advanced technologies, sensors, processors, mobile and video telecommunication, geographic information systems. With China and other nations rising at a frenetic pace, the market for the design, production, application, and integration of smart technologies is $1.2 trillion over the next decade. Can we seize that future? Here's a challenge. We place 45th out of 93 countries in the share that science and engineering degrees make up of bachelor's degrees. We will innovate less as a country. You'll innovate less as a metropolis if we don't embrace science and technology. We lag on the conversion of innovation into homegrown production. We've gone from running a trade surplus in advanced technology to running a trade deficit. Going forward, we're going to innovate less if we don't produce more. We must make things again in the United States. So it's time to rediscover our innovation mojo in our voc-ed schools, right? In our research labs, on our factory floors, and the tradable goods and service sectors that drive wealth creation. Finally, the next economy has got to be opportunity rich. And all the sectors I've just described, exports, manufacturing, innovation, guess what? They pay decent wages. They pay decent benefits. They're part of just not more jobs, but better jobs. Here's our challenge. Over the next several decades, the United States is growing very diverse. African Americans and Hispanics will move from being about a quarter of our workforce to 40%. And yet, only 18% of Hispanics, 25% of African Americans have completed an associate's degree or higher, contrasting sharply with the rates for whites and Asians. In the decades ahead, upgrading the education and skills of our diverse workforce is no longer just an issue of fairness and equity. It is a national issue of national competitiveness. It's frankly an issue of national security. So that is a macro vision of a very different kind of economy for the United States, one that's productive, one that's sustainable, one that's inclusive. Here's my second proposition. That economy will be determined, it'll be shaped, it'll be delivered, it'll be led by cities and metropolitan areas. The top 100 metropolitan areas in this country, and again, Buffalo is the 50th largest, sit in only 12% of our land mass. They house two-thirds of our population. They generate three-quarters of our GDP. And they seamlessly envelop cities, older suburbs, mature suburbs, exurbs, and rural towns on the periphery. That is the new spatial geography of the economy. It's not cities versus suburbs or suburbs versus rural. It's cities plus suburbs plus rural. They pack a powerful punch. Chicago, 67% of the state of the population of the state of Illinois, 78% of that state's GDP. Seattle, 51% of the residents in the state of Washington, 69% of its economic output. We still think of the United States at time as still a nation of rural areas and small towns. Metro areas generate the majority of GDP in 47 of the top 50 states, including such, quote, rural states as Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, and Arkansas. There really is no American economy. What we have is a network of powerful metropolitan economies. And metros are powerful because they concentrate and agglomerate networks of large firms, small enterprises, skilled labor, advanced research institutions, schools and colleges, business associations, and yes, government. Now, let's talk about that growth model I presented before. Exports, low carbon, innovation, opportunity. On every single element of the next economy, these top 100 metros make an outsized contribution. On exports, they produce an estimated 65% of our exports, including 75% of services that are sold abroad. These are our logistical hubs. They concentrate the movement of people and goods by air, rail, and sea. Beyond exports with regard to the low carbon, particularly with regard to the clean tech sector of the clean economy, they generate 78% of the jobs in solar energy, 80% in wind energy, 83% of the jobs in energy research, 90% of the jobs in green architecture, design, and construction. And they are our knowledge centers. This is where the skilled workforce of this country come to live and work and play. So how do you perform in this next economy? Well, your two-county metro area is home to about 1.1 million people, 5.9% of New York State's population. You contain 6.2% of the jobs in the state, 6.1% of all science and engineering jobs, and 7.1% of your state's exports. Your unemployment rate is lower than the state's as a whole. You punch above your weight on exports and export intensity. Not surprisingly, you can see Canada from here. I'll let that pass. 40% of your exports come from three sectors: chemicals, machinery, business services. Your position on this border is something that other cities and metros would kill for, because this is not just our largest trading partner. This is essentially an integrated economy with the United States, and you are experiencing the positive part of being there. Low carbon, you punch way above your weight. 50th largest metro, you're the 37th largest clean economy job center. Waste to energy, hydropower, geothermal, fuel cells, renewable energy, you are punching above your weight. Higher intensity of clean jobs is a distinctive share of total employment. And on innovation, you have a strong and very distinctive legacy in manufacturing. For the past 25 years, the United States tried to tell itself we were going to be a post-industrial economy. Any place that is a post-industrial economy will cease to innovate over time. It's not, you may not experience it in 5 years, you may not experience it in 15 years, you may not even experience it in 25 years, but guarantee, if you stop producing, you stop innovating. And mark my words, manufacturing and advanced industry is going to have a renaissance in this country due to rising wages in China, clean, reliable energy in the United States, and the desire for global companies to have more control over their supply chains, particularly post the shocks of Fukushima and so forth. And finally, on opportunity, you perform much better than the United States as a whole on skilled immigrant composition. 36% of your Buffalo immigrants are high-skilled, defined as those with a bachelor's degree or higher, compared to 30% for the United States. And the University of Buffalo, it's a talent magnet. 5,000 international students studying there every year. So look, I don't want to minimize the challenges you all have. And I'll talk just a little bit about one challenge I think you have to focus on. You've got challenge on racial and ethnic disparities in education. You've got big challenges around municipal fragmentation and fiscal stress. And the one challenge I'll just say something about very briefly is on sprawl and decentralization. You know, I could understand sprawl in Phoenix, right? I can understand it in Atlanta. But you've managed to have sprawl without growth. And you got to really work at that. From 1950 to 2000, while the population of this metropolis grew by 7% over 50 years, the urbanized area tripled from 123 square miles to 367 square miles. Between 1980 and 2006, the region population declined by 6%. The developed area grew by 38%. As people have spread out, so have jobs. There are a higher percentage of jobs more than 10 miles away where we are eating today than within 3 miles of the downtown. You know, how you grow physically affects how you grow economically. Sprawl without growth dissipates your energies, it increases your fiscal costs, and it ensures that you fail to realize the tangible benefits of density and, frankly, community. And there's one thing about Buffalo, it's there's a community here. So what I mostly have focused on are assets and attributes and advantages. Because if you want to grow your economy, what you need to do is you have to strengthen your strengths. But there are a few liabilities here that this city and this metropolis have the ability to take hold of. So final proposition, because I know everyone wants to talk about the Buffalo Billion. How do you unleash the entrepreneurial energies of a city and metropolis? Three things. First, you've got to innovate locally at this level to engineer the shift from an economy that's characterized by debt and consumption to one that is productive and sustainable. Here is the challenge with the prior economy. It minimized the difference between cities and metros. A Walmart outside of Buffalo is the same as a Walmart outside of Boston. It's the same design. It's the same footprint. It's the same goods sold in the store. I would say that a housing subdivision outside of Buffalo is probably the same as a housing subdivision outside of Boston. We have failed to understand that the way places grow in the world is by building on their distinctive strengths. What Buffalo exports is quite different from what Boston exports. And what makes Buffalo a special metropolis, particularly this proximity to Canada, is very different from what drives Boston. The next economy is going to reward metros that don't copycat, don't have fanciful illusions, but build from their special assets and strengthen their strengths. Prior economy also lacked any fiscal discipline. Cities and suburbs competed to literally move businesses a few miles across artificial borders. The next economy is we're going to reward cities and suburbs that collaborate to compete rather than compete against each other. We're up against metros now in China, in India, in Brazil, other parts of Latin America and Asia that are 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 million in size. It makes absolutely no sense for municipalities of 10 or 20,000 people to be competing with each other to move retail businesses with tax subsidies, with abatements, when we're up against this kind of competition. So collaborate to compete is a new mantra. What we have tried to do at Brookings, obviously with others around the country, is set out to adapt the discipline of private sector business planning to the practice of metropolitan economic development. And we've worked closely with metros across the country, Northeast Ohio, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Greater Seattle, Louisville, Lexington, Phoenix, Mesa. And each of these places is trying to design a detailed economic initiative. This is not shelfware. These are not reports that people can just read and admire and observe. This is about moving to action. In Northeast Ohio, they're talking about retooling manufacturing firms and retraining industrial workers, and they're doing it. In the Twin Cities, they're talking about spurring entrepreneurial activity and commercialization of innovation, and they're doing it. In Greater Seattle, they are becoming a global hub of clean economy IT because of the presence not only of Microsoft, but of large energy-efficient building firms like McKinstry. These are low-cost but high-impact business plans. They're primed to attract public and private sector investment. I think as you think about the Buffalo Billion, this is exactly the kind of evidence-driven, performance-measured, accountable, transparent process that this city and metropolis needs to go through. Everyone will have their ideas about how to spend and invest, but there's nothing like evidence. Now, what you did with the Western New York Economic Development Strategic Plan, the regional councils, was an unbelievable start towards both collaborating to compete and to having a data infrastructure and a platform. You have a pretty clear sense here, frankly, better than most parts of the country, of the innovative firms, clusters, and institutions that drive growth, but also the critical role that quality placemaking plays in productive economy shaping. It's not just about the firms and the clusters at the end of the day. It's about having that quality of place, that livability, those special neighborhoods, those special communities, whether they're in the city or whether they're in their suburbs. So I think the governor's $1 billion challenge raises the stakes. It really asks you to identify a targeted set of investments and interventions based on evidence that will put Buffalo back on track. And there's a lot to look at around the world and in the United States. So you don't need to reinvent the wheel. What you do need to do is to look at other similarly situated places, cities and metropolitan areas, that frankly over the last 10 or 20 or 35 years have taken a very tough set of economic conditions. Think Torino after the collapse of Fiat. Think Barcelona after the Spanish dictatorship. Think many of the northern England cities or the German cities after their deindustrialization. They have come back because they have had strategies and the equivalent of business plans that build on evidence. Second piece, let's assume you can innovate locally. Let's assume you can identify a set of targeted investments and interventions. At that point, what you need is the help and support of state and national government and the private sector. Let's put the national government aside for now. Okay, because we're in an election year, so we're not expecting anything to happen. You don't have a hypothetical question in this state about the role of your state government. I really think that New York is open for business. I think what is happening in Albany today, and I have to tell you, Albany was the joke of state legislatures and the joke of state government in the country for a long period of time. But what you're doing with your budget and your financing is sending signals to the market and sending signals to other states that you're open business. Your commitment to clean energy, your sustained investments in infrastructure, innovation, higher education, your creation of a nimble, more market-oriented infrastructure bank. These are the kind of platform setters that, frankly, in the absence of federal leadership, states have to do to help their cities and metros. And then on metro alignment, what happened last year with the regional council basically sent a signal that the state is not going to dictate. States can't do this. They're not economies. They're political jurisdictions. The state is not going to dictate the shape of your economy. It's going to build from the bottom up. It's going to look to Western New York or Central New York or the Finger Lakes or Long Island or the Hudson Valley so that they can present the kind of visions and investment priorities that make sense for their place and then to have the state come back in the service of it. At some point, we're going to have to get our national government back. Federal governments, national governments really do matter when the competition is this fierce around the world. But we're not waiting for Godot. We're Americans, right? So we're not waiting for some central bureaucracy or technocracy to give us the signal. It's going to happen city by city, metro by metro, state after state. Last piece, networking globally. Let's just go back to how the world evolved. Let's not go too far back. But let's just start at the beginning of the Common Era, the Silk Road, right? A trading route from Asia all the way to Europe and North Africa. let's speed ahead 1,200 years, to the middle of Europe and the Hanseatic League, trading relationships between cities. Before the nation-state, there were cities. Before the nation-states, there were communities that traded with each other, that had a distinctive position. That's the world we're in today. And already I think we have these natural networks that are emerging in the world with places and cities that are maybe dominant in financial services like New York and Tokyo and London, or dominant in advanced manufacturing like Detroit and Monterey and Johannesburg and Cologne, or dominant in other parts of or other sectors of the economy. For Buffalo moving forward, having innovated locally, having the support of a state government that's innovative and imaginative, creative, supportive, you need to network globally. You need to figure out beyond Toronto, frankly, right? And it's great to be this close to Toronto. You can feel Toronto from here. You're going to have to figure out who your other trading partners are around the world, and then you're going to have to get to know them really, really well. Because at the end of the day, global trade and exchange and commerce is based on relationships. It's not just based on policy. It's based on political, corporate, civic, and university leaders making the trek to the next generation of trading partners for this country and beyond. So innovate locally, advocate nationally, network globally. That's the sort of general framework, that's the general playbook towards a next economy that is productive, sustainable, and innovative. I'll just close with these thoughts. Buffalo was clean before clean was cool, right? Because of hydroelectricity, because of what Nikola Tesla imagined with Niagara Falls and its potential to power this city and other places. Buffalo was innovative before innovation was a prerequisite for city and metropolitan growth. When you think about what the city and metropolis achieved in the latter part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, it is stunning, right? And Buffalo has assets and attributes and location that is really incomparable. And I have to say, having been all over the United States, there are only one class of people who are obsessed with where they grew up, and that's people who grew up here. And so as you go forward, prize what you have, because you do have a sense of community. You have a great legacy. You have an incomparable location, and you have assets, attributes, and advantages to be built on. So seize the moment. Make the Buffalo Billion not just yield $1 billion in outcome, but 5, 10, 15 billion, and then over time set a platform for growth and prosperity. Thank you very much.
A reminder to our radio audience, you are listening to Buffalo City Forum. Our guest is Bruce Katz, Vice President of the Brookings Institution and an advisor to the Western New York Regional Economic Development Council. We'll take written questions from our studio audience. If you have a question, write it down on the card, hold it up, and we'll have someone come around and collect those cards. I'll ask as many as time permits. And again, we want to thank our program sponsors, Independent Health and M&T Bank. Bruce, thank you very much for that that lecture. You, I think, gave everyone a shot in the arm here and make us feel a little bit better about where we are and who we are. What role, if you can explain for us, what role you will play, what role will Brookings play in going forward now with the Regional Council and this billion-dollar pledge from the governor?
So the short answer is I'll play whatever role the governor wants me to play. First of all, the Brookings contribution to this effort will be pro bono. We are the oldest think tank in the United States. We are resourced for many national philanthropies like the Rockefeller Foundation, large global institutions like J.P. Morgan Chase. So this will be a pro bono contribution. And frankly, we're making that contribution not just because of my relationship with the governor, but because there is no other state in this country that has said we will make a $1 billion investment in a particular city off of an evidence-driven process. So we like to go where reform and possibilities lie. I think our role should be to help University of Buffalo and others with the analytics. We collect a crazy amount of data at the Brookings Institution around this next economy model because we think every city and metropolitan area needs to understand their starting point on the path to productive, sustainable, and innovation growth. And again, it's so different and variegated, we need to understand that. And second, I think having done work here and around the world, we can give you a pretty good sense of, you know, what can you learn from Bilbao, which is a metropolis of comparable size, former manufacturing powerhouse in the Basque country of Spain. What can you learn from other parts of Europe, Japan, and elsewhere? So we can draw on these innovations from around the world, bring them to Buffalo, and then the key is to adapt and tailor them to your own unique experience. So we're here to advise and inform. At the end of the day, you all make the decisions because you know this place better than anyone.
Put that $1 billion in perspective for us. How significant is that? You're saying you called it bold in your speech.
$1 billion is very significant if you invest it in the right way as a public sector. And you know, my challenge with the public sector in many parts of the country is the public sector likes to spread money around like peanut butter because it sort of operates from a perspective of let's just have everyone be happy. It's an odd, you know, sort of vision of shaping an economy or making places. Let's just make everyone be happy. Well, you know, that's not how you get high return on investment. And that's what $1 billion is. It's an investment. It's not just spending. So I think, you know, my perspective, if you make the right set of bets and investments, you're looking to leverage up, you know, obviously private sector capital. And private sector investment of many, many times. And then most importantly, if you've done the right things, you've set a platform for longer-term growth. So the real return is not the immediate hit. It's the hit that's going to happen over 5 or 10 or 15 years. You know, most parts of Europe, when I talk to these places that were industrial powerhouses prior to the Second World War, to some extent a little after the Second World War, they'd like to talk about 25 or 35 years as the right time frame to think about regeneration and rejuvenation. Obviously, what you are doing today will have a dramatic effect on the next generation of Buffalo residents, and the key is just to do it smartly and strategically.
What's the best way to invest that money? I mean, what form? And I'm not asking necessarily for specifics, but is this... You know, are these tax assessment or incentives? Are these startup costs that you should cover with this $1 billion? You know, what do we do with it?
Well, all I can do is tell you how other places have invested money, and then you know, again, at the end of the day, there needs to be a Buffalo playbook, and it has to build off of your distinctive assets. But if you take a place, you know, like Barcelona, for example, right, and you say, okay, what did Barcelona do? To emerge from the shadow of Franco to become one of the most entrepreneurial cities and metropolitan areas in Europe and, frankly, the world. I mean, there is a Barcelona brand, right? One thing they did was to invest in what they call innovation districts. So these are areas, former industrial areas of their city and metropolis, sound familiar, right, that are now anchored by educational institutions, but then populated both by residents and by small technical media entrepreneurial firms, right? So they have basically been able to become a hotspot, really, for small-scale innovation in Europe with a look towards the world. And they've branded themselves in that way. In other parts of Europe, and here we would probably look to a place like Munich, or a place like Stuttgart, places that were really devastated during the Second World War. What they've done is created a very intricate network of advanced research institutions and skills intermediaries that support their production engines. So if you go to Audi or you go to BMW or you go to Porsche, you go to the major automotive or other engineering-oriented companies in Munich or Stuttgart, what you will find, and this is a really strange experience, are university professors who are literally on the factory floor. And you go, well, what are you doing here? We're here to crack the code on product innovation, on process innovation, right? So we're not off in the ivory tower thinking big thoughts, or we're not at the Brookings Institution. No, we're actually on the factory floor working with companies that are export-oriented to help them do what they do even better. Okay, so those are examples coming out of Europe. And look, we were an industrial powerhouse. So if you want to find similar situations, you go to other older industrial places and see how they've transitioned. But we should be looking to the emerging countries. We go to Curitiba today in Brazil. We go to Bogota, you know, in Colombia. What we will find in these places is not the kind of heavy rail or light rail systems we've built in the United States. We'll find bus rapid transit, okay, that have sort of fixed guideways so you can at least get some density around the various transit hubs, but they're almost fit to our suburban form and our sprawling decentralized form. So, you know, whether it's Europe, whether it's Asia, Latin America, or other parts of the United States, I think at this point of the process, the key is what are your assets and who's doing best in the world? And then the question is, can Buffalo do better? And that's what you can do with a billion.
You told us not to take notes, but I did. You said you said that we were punching above our weight in exports,
yep.
Low carbon,
yep.
Innovation,
yep.
Opportunity. Sounds good.
Well, you're
how
punching
come things aren't better?
Well, I was selective on some things there. Because, again, and I brought out the sprawl and decentralization numbers, which are pretty horrific. And obviously I can bring up a lot of statistics around racial and ethnic disparities on education, which, again, I regard as one of the central issues facing this country. We are demographically blessed. We are demographically blessed because we are so diverse. Other countries would kill to have our diversity because they understand that we are both an aging country, but we have a younger population, primarily African American and Hispanic, who can replenish the workforce. They can't do that in Germany. They can't do that in China, right? So the United States is demographically blessed if we have the presence of mind to upgrade the education and skills of the next workforce. This is not just an issue of fairness and equity, though it is. It is an issue of competitiveness. If we do this, this will be another American century. And the other piece about our diverse base here, particularly all those skilled foreign students going to the University of Buffalo, if they stay here, this is a matter partly of federal immigration law. Again, it would be nice to have a national government. If they stay here, they will trade to their home countries. We had no colonies as a country. We were a colony. But what we have is a diverse population base that can reach to all corners of the earth and trade goods and services ad infinitum. No other country can do that.
You, I think, already answered a question from our audience about that, about importing and exporting, and how do we get in? How do we get into these countries? How do you get your foot in the door?
Well, you can fall out of bed and be in Canada here. So that's so obviously what will be a very simple exercise, and I know there are many people in this room and throughout this metropolis, large, small, and medium-sized enterprises that engage with Canada, and frankly are welcoming Canadian shoppers, you know, over the border quite often here, and Canadian investment. I think what we have to have is an exporting culture, first and foremost, in the United States. This is as much cultural as economic. But we have been such a large market in this country, and we've been so housing-focused and consumption-focused that we really haven't looked abroad. And I regard the United States as almost export-phobic. And, I was with a CEO of a large, very large global financial institution that's not American-owned. It's owned. It's a British financial institution, and they basically said, we regard the United States from an export perspective as an emerging market. You are underperforming because you're so internally focused. So what we need are really, frankly, holding hands, right? Because if American firms are going to sell in Brazil or sell in other parts of Latin America or sell in India, China, Korea, or elsewhere. What they need, both from government, and this is where the national government has a huge role because of the State Department, our consular services, the Commerce Department, international trade, the Ex-Im Bank, and the private sector. We're going to have guides here so that American firms, not just the biggest companies, but small and medium-sized firms, can negotiate through different languages, different cultures, different regulations, different ways of doing business. Again, you know, right now, and I'll just say this as, you know, just one comment about what Washington is like today. The Ex-Im Bank will run out of authority at the end of May, okay? They are a critical role in export promotion and finance, both for large companies like Boeing and for small and medium-sized enterprises. How complicated should it be for the Congress to reauthorize the Ex-Im Bank? It's completely self-sustaining, right? It makes loans, makes money off the loans, and pays for itself. This can't be a rocket science to reauthorize the Ex-Im Bank. We've got to have a national government at some point in time to help the entrepreneurial energies and dynamism of our cities and metros look abroad for business.
A lot of questions about your comments regarding urban sprawl. What can a community like Buffalo, Western New York do to mitigate and reverse sprawl? Can you do that?
Well, there's many different aspects to sprawl, but I think the one part of sprawl is that it's not genetic and it's not built into our Constitution. It really is part of the rules of the development game. We've set up a set of rules around tax and spend and regulation and administration where sprawl is the cheaper way. Now, I do think because of the rise in gas prices, and I do think because of some serious shifts in demographic preferences. When I talk to most people under the age of 30, they want to live in some cores. Now, that may be a downtown of a city, or it may be a suburban or exurban village. It's not just about city. It's really about density and walkability and livability, right? And that can happen in many different aspects of a metropolitan area or satellite cities, right, that are 20 or 25 miles away. What we need here is to set up the rules of the game, both the zoning and the land use and the financing structure, so that we tilt the playing field, or at least balance, level the playing field, between regeneration and density and low-density decentralization. Right now, I think the rules are still balanced away from the kind of livable neighborhoods that, frankly, we created back in the 1890s or the 19-teens, all right? I mean, think about these amazing places we created in the United States. That's what everyone wants today. So we're going to have to think about different ways to mash up residential and work. I mean, we used to separate all these things. It's called Euclidean zoning back from the 1920s. Well, you had to have a bedroom community over here. Your work was over there. Well, we basically created these distended metropolitan areas in which we live. So a lot of this is about the basic rules, both in the public and private sector. They are human-made. They can be undone, right? And right now, because of these shifts in demographic preferences, one last aside, when I went to college, the top film of the year was Blade Runner. I don't know how many people remember this film, right? Okay, Harrison Ford, L.A., 2150, apocalyptic. You know, it was a dangerous place, right? And I grew up in Brooklyn, New York in the 70s. Seemed a little like that, actually. Fast forward to what my kids grew up on is a steady diet of Seinfeld, Sex and the City, right? Cities are hip. Cities are cool. You know, these places of density and diversity are exactly where you want to be. It's the center of everything. So culture changes, right? And then policy and politics and business practice catch up in many respects. And I think that's the process we're going through in the United States. But this is not a rocket science. We all know how to build these kind of communities. We just have to get the rules at least to level the playing field. In my view, they have to tilt back towards the smart and sustainable growth.
So going forward, if we think about this region as a metropolitan area, you use that term a lot, what does that mean to you, or what should that mean to us? Is it the city of Buffalo? Is it a little bit beyond? Is it Niagara Falls?
Well, I think the spatial geography is the metropolis, right? Because the way economists think about this is about labor markets and commuter sheds, which, again, are just more distended in the United States because of our commuting patterns. Housing markets, which are really metropolitan-wide. And, you know, to have metropolitan areas of the size and scale we have in the United States is an advantage in many respects, because what it allows you to do is to say to a business, whether one that's located here or one that wants to invest, you know, we have a range of locations for you to consider, right? You may want to be on the border with our largest trading partner. You may want to be in the downtown. For households, some of whom are just starting out post-college, you want to be in that loft in the core of the city. Perhaps others, once they have children, need a backyard. I mean, again, a lot of these are cultural predispositions, so none of this is uniform. But different people at different times of their life cycle and work cycle have different preferences. What a metropolitan area does is it gives everyone a chance to basically execute those preferences, realize those preferences. It gives choice. What we've not had in the United States for a long period of time, frankly, is choice, because we've sort of abandoned our central cores and moved to the periphery. It's obviously fiscally wasteful. Frankly, I think it's economically unproductive, and now it's counter to a lot of preferences both for firms and for individuals. So the right geography of a metropolitan area, or the right geography of the economy, is a metropolitan area. The question about investment, however, it needs to be targeted. It needs to really have this sense of what's going to be the highest return, what's going to set a platform, and frankly, how do I double down on success? You know, I was in New York City, I'm trying to remember when this was, maybe about 6 months ago, and I was meeting with the deputy mayor, Bob Steele, who is really one of the catalysts behind the Applied Sciences District. So if you go to New York City in 2005, and you asked anyone involved in the public and private sector, what's the one major economic development strategy for New York City, they would say, we're building a stadium on the west side of Manhattan. Pretty curious, right? I mean, like, the west side of Manhattan really needed a stadium. But that's what they wanted to do because they wanted to win the Olympics. Okay, they didn't win the Olympics. Sanity prevailed. If you go to New York City today and say, what is the number one economic development investment that they're making, it's the Applied Sciences District on Roosevelt Island. Worldwide competition, $100 million to basically prepare the infrastructure. They had Stanford trying to basically come into New York. Ultimately, they gave it to Cornell and Technion. And when I met with Bob Steele, the deputy mayor, he said, what do you think is the number one thing we should do from our economic strategy? I said, double down. Double down. Because that'll be the gift that keeps on giving. You are diversifying your economy away from finance and real estate towards technology, towards innovation. I mean, it may not bear fruit in the next 5 years, but trust me, in the next 25 years, oh my God, New York City is going to be a technological, innovative hub to rival Silicon Valley, right? So I look around this region, you know, and Aaron Bartley took me on a quick tour today, and I was able to see the medical campus, you know, in the near downtown. Wow. I mean, that's pretty impressive stuff that's happened in a very, you know, small period of time, and you're going to have 15, 17,000 jobs in that area.
So that, do we double down on that?
Well, I'm just saying that the notion is to understand your strengths. After analysis, after inquiry, it might not make sense to do that. But it starts from a premise that you just don't spread investment around like peanut butter. Global corporations don't do it. Why should government do it? Particularly if what we're talking about is economy shaping and placemaking. So it's a different kind of psychological perspective. We're not just going to add up the state legislature and let's just divide the money. I mean, that's not a market approach. I mean, market approaches tend to be targeted and focused.
What would you say to someone who says, we need to go after something big. We need a big company here. We need we need Yahoo. We need Google. We need a Fortune 500 company to set up shop here. Is that the right approach?
Well, I think for most of these corporations, when I talk to corporations, you know, of that sort, what they'll say to me is, you know, we obviously like cities and metros and states to throw money at us. You know, we're only human. Right? But what we really want to know is, do they have what it takes? Because at the end of the day, if a corporation of the kind you have just described are going to come here, what they're going to ask you within an hour, actually, of the first conversation is, where are our workers going to live? Because our workers like to live in these kind of communities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How are they going to get to work? Where are their kids going to go to school? Right? So you can't bribe corporations just to show up when they understand that they're in a global competition for talent, right? And talent is footloose and fancy free. So they want to basically be in a place that works for them. That's the new math of the economy. So I think what you need is a more holistic piece. And frankly, even the southern states. And the southern states were brilliant, you know, in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s of beginning to attract foreign companies. And we're talking about large automotive companies, right, that have moved into the South or into the border states. And what they have said repeatedly is, they said, fine, we get the tax incentives or other kinds of incentives. Do you have a community college here? Do you have an advanced research institution? Because guess what? We're moving from Stuttgart, right? We get the interplay, the ecosystem of advanced research and skilled workers and land policy, and transport. It's not just about money. So I think post-recession we need a more integrated perspective, and then we can, you know, you all can look at a menu of options and then decide what are the best things to invest in. But understand, global corporations now, whether they're American-owned or internationally owned, they get out. They understand what the rest of the world has to offer, and they expect us to offer it to them as well.
Before I ask the final question, I do want to present a small token of our appreciation for you being here, Bruce Katz from the Brookings Institution.
I really appreciate that. Thanks.
Final question for you, and I'll ask you, you know, to be brief with your comments here as we near the end of our hour. Buffalo has several nicknames, monikers, slogans. We're the city of good neighbors. We're the queen city of the Great Lakes. We're the city of no illusions. If everything goes perfectly, if we play our cards right, if we double down on the right thing with this $1 billion, help us come up with a new moniker for Buffalo, maybe in 10 years.
Well, I always thought your moniker was the city of light.
That too.
And I think that, I mean, and I really do think that Americans have no sense of history, obviously, right? But if you go back to the 1890s and to that vision that Tesla had of a city lit by the hydroelectric power of Niagara Falls, my Lord, was he ahead of his time. You were clean before you were clean. You were innovative before it was sexy. There is a legacy and a location and a set of attributes here to build on. The past is not prologue. We have the potential in this country to rebuild and renew ourselves, and we should do so.
Bruce Katz, thank you very much for joining us on Buffalo City Forum. Bruce Katz is vice president of the Brookings Institution and an advisor to the Western New York Regional Economic Development Council. We want to thank our sponsors for making it possible for us to be here today, Independent Health and M&T Bank. I'm Jim Ranney. Thanks for joining us on the radio and in the studio. Have a great afternoon.